From the west southwest at 5, 11 degrees Racine, 12 Kenosha, wind chill is zero. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for WGTD and The Morning Show comes from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside, offering online degrees in sustainable management and health information management technology. Online degrees for emerging careers from the University of Wisconsin-Parkside in partnership with UW Extension. To learn more, visit uwp.edu. And we welcome you to the Tuesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. That marvelous piece of music is the setting of Ave Maria by Franz Biebl, and that gorgeous performance of it, perhaps the best I have ever heard, is by an extraordinary vocal ensemble called Voces 8. Eight really brilliantly talented young British singers, and they have gained renown not only in Britain, but all around the world, singing everything from polyphony of the Renaissance to brand new works that they themselves have commissioned. It is indeed a privilege to be able to welcome them to Carthage College for a concert this Thursday evening, the 15th of February. And it is a supreme honor for me to be speaking with one of the members of Voces 8, Barnaby Smith, who is one of the two countertenors who is part of this group. It is six men, two women, and the sound they make together, as you have just heard, is incomparably beautiful. And so we will speak about the history of this group, their mission, and talk a little bit about some of the lovely works that are going to be part of Thursday night's concert at Carthage. Barnaby Smith, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here. The honor is all mine.
I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you, and I am speaking to you via the wonders of modern technology to you in your home someplace in England. Where are you speaking to us from?
Well, we actually arrived in the U.S. yesterday, so we flew into Wichita, Kansas last night, and we're up here doing some work today and tomorrow. So if I sound a little bit low, that's because I'm perhaps a fraction jet-lagged.
Well, thank you for making time for this. Explain to us when the group Voces 8 was first created, and by whom, and were you part of the group at that point?
I was. Yeah. I actually founded the group, and now I'm, as well as singing it, I also direct the ensemble. So we began in 2005, actually, originally formed from a group of friends who used to sing in a youth choir together, and we were no longer considered to be youth at that point, so we all had to leave that choir. And instead, to fill our time in the college holidays, we decided that we'd arrange, I suppose, glorified parties at my parents' house, where I used to have my friends over and we'd do a little bit of singing, perhaps go and sing a concert or sing some church services in one of the local institutions, and it all kind of grew from there, really. So it was just a group of friends.
What kind of a youth choir were you a part of?
It was called the Millennium Youth Choir. I mean, it was run by a wonderful organisation called the Royal School of Church Music, which was actually founded in England, but now also has an American arm to that organisation. And it was kind of a national setup, so students would come from all over the UK to take part. There were about 36 of us, so it was a nice chamber choir size, and that's where we all met.
Was the voicing similar to what's in Vocis 8, that is, with female sopranos, but then male countertenors, as well as tenors and basses?
It was, yeah. I mean, we're in the Millennium Youth Choir specifically, we used to mix female and male altos, but it's quite a common thing in England that the cathedral choirs especially have boy trebles and also countertenors, so men who sing alto. Of course, as we've now moved into the 21st century, and as we know, women's rights are very, very important, and equal opportunities now suggests that, of course, ladies should be able to sing as well. So the church is really trying very hard to change its constitution. And I'm delighted to say that we've had a couple of major appointments in London at some of the biggest cathedrals and choirs recently where ladies have been appointed into the role of alto. So who knows, perhaps in the future of Vocis 8, when there's a vacancy as well, we may also make that decision.
When you launched Vocis 8 back in 2005, did you launch it with the intention of being a fully functioning professional ensemble in which this was how all of you would make your living? Or was it not necessarily that sort of venture with those sorts of lofty aspirations?
Well, no, not to begin with. I mean, we were all studying to be solo singers and that sort of thing. So shortly after we founded it, we were invited to a competition out in Italy. And to us, it sounded like a great free holiday. You know, we were invited by this organization to go and sing in Venice and the surrounding area for 10 days. And they were going to pay for our accommodation, for our travel. And all we had to do was sing some concerts and then take part in this competition. So we thought, well, this sounds great, you know, in the summer break. So we all went over there. And when we got there, we realized it was really quite a serious thing. So we did a sort of few days of very intensive practice, and we actually won that competition. And that's really what kicked the whole thing up a gear or two, because we suddenly thought, hang on a minute, people actually are enjoying what we're doing, and now they want us to go and sing for them. So maybe there's a business in this. And that's really where that sort of switch was flicked, as it were.
Wow. How is it that it was the eight of you who came together to form this group? I'm just curious because it could easily have been five of you coming together, or a SATB quartet, or a larger group, perhaps. How was it that it happened to be the eight of you and in this particular array of voices?
Sure. Well, when we went and did that competition, we were actually, at the time, we were a sort of 20-piece chamber choir. But one of the categories in this particular competition was a close harmony category, so a contemporary repertoire, jazz, and pop, that sort of stuff. And so we decided to do that with fewer voices. And the best thing that fitted the music we wanted to sing was a kind of double quartet, so two sopranos, two altos, two tenors, and two basses. And that's really how we came to form that particular array of voices.
Tell us what you are like as personalities. I think a lot of times when we listen to a group that sings together as seamlessly as you do, I think sometimes even unconsciously, we leap to the conclusion that all of you, in a sense, are in perfect sync in terms of your personality types as well. I suspect that that's not necessarily the case, although obviously there must be some kind of marvelous rapport between you. How would you describe the array of personalities that comprise Vocis 8?
Well, the group's very much like a family, to be honest. So we get on most of the time really, really well. And then occasionally, of course, we have a little tiff, and then it's all sort of resolved a couple of hours later. One of the difficult things about my particular role, I'm the artistic director, and I have to facilitate all of the group's work. So one of the brilliant things about the group, I think, and one of the really exciting things about being part of the ensemble is that we sing in so many different styles, as you said at the top of the program. And in order to be able to do that, we also need people with a very broad range of expertise. So it's not like we're eight people who specialize in Renaissance polyphony who happen to sing jazz. Now, we have sort of two or three guys who specialize in that, but one or two who specialize in jazz. And then, of course, with that, we also get very different personality types. So you get some people who are, you know, really organized and like everything to be planned at the beginning of the day so we know exactly where we're going. And then some other people who would much rather get out of bed and, you know, just stop for lunch on the way when they feel like it, rather than having a rigid plan in place. And it's always quite interesting to try and balance those personalities. And of course, with that also comes a broad range of interests as well. So it's really great because, you know, variety is the spice of life. And
of course,
one of the things I enjoy about being in the group is that I can, you know, sort of get really interested in the types of other things that people in the group are interested in. And they, of course, also take an interest in my interest. And so it's very much like a family, and we have a great time when we're away.
What are your most important responsibilities as the group's artistic director?
Well, I would suggest the most important thing is to get the group on stage singing to the best of its ability. And that's not actually as easy as it sounds, because we sing so many concerts that we do about 120 concerts a year. And of course, both singers and the group go in and out of form a little bit. So one of the hardest things I find is trying to work with the schedule on a daily basis to try and make sure the group is prepared to the best of its ability to give the best concert it can. I think the other thing is probably also trying to facilitate the eight very different personalities. I wouldn't say it's difficult, more interesting, but of course it has its challenges. And some days are good days, some days are bad days. Some days do test my leadership, and sometimes I sit in my room at night and I think, wow, I did a really great job today. But sometimes I sit there and think, you know what, the group probably would have done better without me sticking my oar in today. So it's quite interesting, but it's that sort of leadership role which I find very, very fun and fascinating.
How steady has the personnel remained for Vocis 8 over these years?
I think we've been going for 12 years and had something like 18 or 19 members, so pretty steady. I mean, invariably now, somebody might have one person change each season. So this latest season, Eleanor, our second soprano, is new. Actually, at the end of this season, Chris, our counselor, who's been with the group since the very beginning, is retiring, and also our baritone, Rob. So we're in the unusual situation that we have two members leaving. But normally, we probably turn over maybe one singer a season. But it's a very difficult job because, you know, we're away for 6-7 months of the year, and so trying to balance your work and with your life at home can be tricky. So we work really hard with that, and that generally means that people can have a longer tenure in the ensemble.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking today on the morning show with Barnaby Smith. He is the artistic director and sings countertenor with Vocis 8. And Vocis 8 is one of the most highly regarded small vocal ensembles in the world. And they are at Carthage College Thursday evening for a concert that we are all very, very excited about. And it is a concert called Sing Joyfully, and it features a wide range of repertoire. And we will talk about some specifics of the repertoire in just a couple of minutes. Barnaby Smith, I wonder if you could say a word about the extraordinarily fine blend and balance that your group achieves. And I think for particularly a layperson listening to such a blend, they might assume that it has everything to do with choosing the right voices that are just sort of meant to be together. And I'm sure that is an element of that success, but by no means the entire story. Talk for a moment about how this gorgeous, wonderful, pure blend is achieved.
Well, I mean, you've sort of mentioned part of it absolutely already, which is choosing the right voices. You know, the voice is part of our anatomy, so it comes in all different shapes and sizes depending who the person is. I always talk about the analogy with athletes in this particular instance, because if you imagine what sort of frame and muscular structure you have to be a successful sprinter compared to being a successful marathon runner, perhaps, compared to being a successful heavyweight lifter, those kinds of things. They have the people who do those particular disciplines train in very different ways. They form muscle groups in very different ways, and they generally take very different shapes as human beings. And it's exactly the same with the voice. You know, we have singers who train to be pop singers, or singers who train to be musical theatre singers, or singers who train to be opera singers, or singers who train to be choral singers. I think one of the interesting things about the job in Voces 8 is that there's a little bit of everything. So I always say that you have to imagine those people who do the multi-discipline events, you know, the heptathletes, for example. They've sort of got enough strength, but they also have versatility. So finding voices that work in that sort of way is definitely the first part of the challenge. I think the second thing is probably for us is then all learning to sing in the same way at the same time. So as a group, if one person is making a color or singing in a certain style that doesn't match the other seven, then immediately the whole thing breaks down, especially when you're singing unaccompanied, because there's no particular pitched instrument or accompaniment to support the group. So the really crucial thing is that we're all singing the same way with the same tone color all the time. And then with that, you also begin to achieve excellent intonation. And when we achieve excellent intonation, we are locking into overtones, so that the group sound shimmers and shines. And really, that's what we're always searching for. But, you know, I mean, with many things in life, you can do something in a big way, you can do something in a small way. And actually, if you want to achieve great blend, singing softer is also really helpful as well. So, of course, the group can sing really loudly. With eight classically trained singers on stage, we can make a racket, frankly. But we choose most of the time to sing with, you know, a good level of control and restraint, so that the unit can work together. Because at the end of the day, eight people singing for themselves doesn't achieve the same result as eight people singing for one vision. So that's what we always aim for.
What kind of challenge does it represent when you find yourself in a brand new space? For instance, Siebert Chapel on the campus of Carthage, where you will be singing Thursday night, a space in which none of you have ever sung. What kind of challenge does that typically represent? And what is sort of the process by which you acclimate yourself to the space in which you are about to perform?
Well, it's quite interesting, because this is something you learn very much on the job, because we visit so many different venues in a year. When you go in there, I mean, the first thing we always think about as technical singers is the sound. So, you know, depending on the venue, some venues have support the low resonance very well, so support the basses. Others have a really strong soprano resonance. So we kind of have to slightly rebalance the group. And it's as simple as, you know, myself standing out, or one of the other members of the group, listening to the group sing for 2 or 3 minutes and saying, well, I'm hearing the basses really clearly, or I'm not hearing enough of the basses. And then people can judge from within that. The other thing which is really interesting, you know, people always talk about acoustics when you walk into a concert hall. I think the other thing that we think very hard about is about the visual aspect of our presentation, because when you come to a concert, of course, you're hearing a group, but you're also seeing them. And, you know, some concert halls are narrow and long, others are wide and not so long. And so trying to figure out where we can stand on stage, are there different positions we can stand in? You know, if it's a church with a large church, say, with a long resonance, is it effective if we sing not all the time from the stage? Could we go to the back of the church and create a wonderful effect on the acoustic, or maybe process through the church whilst we're singing? All those sorts of things. So we consider those very much when we walk into the venue, and we make fairly subtle adjustments to the way that we sing and the way that we present the show each night as a consequence.
Well, I'm happy to say that in that space where you will be performing, we've had the privilege of hearing groups like the King Singers and Anonymous Four, and are certainly thrilled at the prospect of hearing Voces 8. I'm especially glad that you are singing for us a varied program, which will open with one of my very, very favorite pieces, Sing Joyfully, a wonderful motet by William Byrd, and extending all the way to modern works, including music of Kurt Weill and Duke Ellington and Simon and Garfunkel and Van Morrison. So there will be a plethora of styles represented in this concert. Could you maybe highlight one or two of the works that will be on Thursday night's concert that will be not particularly familiar to our concert goers?
Absolutely. So we're working this season with a new composer in residence, a guy called Jonathan Duff. He's a British composer. Your American audience may know him because he's been commissioned in the past by the Metropolitan Opera in New York, and he's quite a well-known voice in the world of opera. But his choral music, I think, is often fairly neglected by contrast, and it's incredibly beautiful. And In Beauty May I Walk is a very nice setting of a piece of Navajo poetry. And it also actually appears in our latest album, which is called Equinox, where there's a nice recording. And the thing I like about the piece is that he takes a very simple melody. It's just two bars long, and he uses that as a theme throughout, and he spins other melodies around it. So that's particularly beautiful, and I'd be surprised if anybody in the audience has ever heard it before. I think one of my other favorite pieces, perhaps more well-known from the classical side of the repertoire, is the Bogorodice Djevo by Sergei Rachmaninoff, which is a setting of the Ave Maria text, but set in Church Slavonic. And it's actually from Rachmaninoff's setting of the All-Night Vespers. And it's incredibly beautiful. Very simple piece of music, actually. I mean, we often associate Rachmaninoff, of course, with exceptionally complex instrumental writing. But this is incredibly simple, and that's very, very beautiful. So there's lots of things there on the classical side. I'd say also maybe a modern folk song by a beautiful singer-songwriter from the north of England, from Yorkshire, called Kate Rusby, and that's called Underneath the Stars. And I think it always takes people by surprise because it comes in the program where around a lot of other songs that they might recognize the names of or might know from before, but Underneath the Stars nobody's ever heard before, and I think it really stands out as a beautiful piece.
I was also intrigued and excited that there is a little bit of Bach on the program, which appears to be at least a brief nod towards an earlier group known as the Swingle Singers. Can you say a word about that?
Yes, well, so it's Bach's Bohé, which is a lovely little light, fast dance. Of course, you know, when we were growing up, we were inspired to do what we do today by some of the famous groups you've already mentioned, the King Singers, the Swingle Singers, of course, probably the other very well-known English group. And we don't always do a piece of the Swingles music, but it is quite nice. This is just a sort of 90-second little dance, the beginning of the second half, a little bit of a palate cleanser. And it's always nice to acknowledge, I think, people who have inspired you. Mm.
The concert Thursday night is going to feature Voces 8 and their artistic director, Barnaby Smith. Barnaby Smith, thank you so much for making time in your busy schedule in the midst of jet lag to have this conversation with me. I know that many, many people are very, very excited about Thursday night's concert. We wish you safe travels and much joyous singing in the years to come.
Thank you very much. It's been my pleasure.
And here is a little more of the singing of Voces 8, and this is one of the pieces that will be on Thursday evening's program, Underneath the Stars by Kate Rusby.
And there beneath the
Voces 8, this wonderful group, and Kate Rusby's Underneath the Star is one of a number of pieces to be featured on Thursday evening's concert, which begins at 7:30 in Siebert Chapel. Tickets can be purchased at the door. My thanks again to Artistic Director Barnaby Smith for joining me today on The Morning Show. Here's part two of today's program. It's 8:36. Tonight on PBS stations across the country, including Channel 10 in Milwaukee, you can watch yet another fantastic film in the American Experience series. And this one takes a look at a very important event that nevertheless most Americans today know nothing about. It occurred on September 16th, 1920, when Wall Street was literally physically rocked by an enormous, terrifying explosion, which left 38 people dead and several hundred people injured. And needless to say, the city of New York City and beyond, most of America, was left badly shaken by this act of terror. The film that is airing tonight explores not only what happened on that day on Wall Street, but why it happened and the historical backdrop against which such a thing might occur, which on the one hand was a stunning shock and on the other hand was actually not all that much of a surprise because it was, in a sense, springing out of a period of great turbulence in our nation's history. Susan Bellows, to whom we have spoken before, is the senior producer, writer, and director of this film. And I'm very, very pleased to be able to speak with her about it. Again, it's called The Bombing of Wall Street. And Susan Bellows, we welcome you back to The Morning Show.
Well, good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I wonder if you knew more about this than most of the rest of us before you came to this project. Or like the typical American, did you know pretty much next to nothing before you started exploring this event?
No, I actually, it was an event I had never heard of, to be honest, and parallels to some of the events we'd been living through, ourselves, were quite striking. And so it was surprising to me that I'd actually never heard of this event. It came to my attention through an excellent book by a Yale scholar named Beverly Gage. And that really became a kind of foundation for us to dive deeper and sort of understand this event, that the more deeply we explored it, the more we realized how much it kind of revealed about the way in which we as a nation have, over time, struggled with the challenges posed by domestic terrorist acts. And it was sort of really a reminder that kind of, terrorism and the debates that we grapple with today about how best to deal with it has a history. And so we, as a series, became really interested in trying to take a deeper look at that history through this particular event.
Right. And, of course, what's so fascinating, too, is that lots of us have, to various extents, explored and learned about the First World War. And a lot of us know what the Roaring Twenties was all about. But very few of us know about this, in a sense, more slender slice of our history, which kind of rides right between those two periods. Not distinctly, I mean, overlapping both, of course. But it's a really critical moment in our history that nevertheless most of us have not explored. Part of the roots of it, of course, certainly extend back to the First World War, and your film explores some of the ways in which there were tremendous tensions and fears in our country that led to the rise of various espionage and sedition laws. Describe that historical backdrop to us. Just what kind of tensions are we talking about here in America during that First World War and in the years immediately preceding it?
Well, the explosion on Wall Street in 1920 really, occurred at a time when people around the world really were challenging and asking questions about capitalism. I mean, much of this was obviously sparked by the Bolshevik Revolution in 1917, which sort of emerged out of the ashes of World War I. But that revolution had really inspired people around the world to kind of question, you know, capitalism's inequities. And you know, within the United States, there were many, many people who were inspired by Lenin and his calls for revolution. And you know, there were a lot of people also, you know, really worried that Lenin was, you know, encouraging people within our own country to rise up. And, you know, all of this kind of coming on the heels of decades of kind of rising class tension that began to emerge during the Gilded Age. And, you know, America after World War I, you know, was becoming a kind of global financial power. And so all of that were. 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 And so all of that sort of contributed to. 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 World War One, you know, was becoming a kind of global financial power. And so all of that sort of, and so all of that sort of, all of that, and so all of that, 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 all of that, and so all of that contributed, and so all of that contributed, and so all of that contributed, and so all of that contributed. One, you know, was becoming a kind of global financial power, and so all of that power, and so all of that power, and so all of that power. And so all of that shall 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 power. And so all of that shall.
My apologies, we have some kind of difficulty with this disc, with the interview we're hearing today. Let me bring up a different copy of that. Again, you are listening to a preview of tonight's NPR, public radio, PBS series, American Experience, and a documentary which is called The Bombing of Wall Street, in which it looks back at a dramatic moment in September of 1920 when a bomb was set off on Wall Street, which resulted in the killing of about 30 people and the wounding of hundreds others. And it was a very, very frightening moment during a turbulent time in our country's history. Let me bring up a clean copy of the file and see if we can hear a little more of this interview with the producer and narrator.
There were a lot of people also, you know, really worried that Lenin was, you know, encouraging people within our own country to rise up. And, you know, all of this kind of coming on the heels of decades of kind of rising class tension that began to emerge during the Gilded Age. And, you know, America after World War One, you know, was becoming a kind of global financial power. And so all of that sort of contributed to giving rise to this really large class of people who were kind of angry and discontent with the capitalist system and the rising inequities of who it was benefiting and who it wasn't.
Hmm.
So there was a lot of kind of populist insurgency and people were sort of debating what's the best way to sort of challenge some of these inequities, and you know, what emerged out of that were some people, you know, advocating terrorism as a kind of tool. And I think that's part of what the investigation into the bombing and events surrounding it kind of revealed. I think the other thing that it's worth, you know, acknowledging in the, you know, you mentioned specifically coming out of World War One. In that immediate period between the end of World War One, leading up to the bombing, there was sort of an alarming series of very violent labor battles stretching from Seattle to Boston. And then, you know, a year before the bomb exploded on Wall Street, there had been a targeted mail bomb campaign that 30 bombs sent to bankers and government officials. Most of them didn't explode and no one was injured. But then a month after that, in June of 1919, a bomb and the bomber exploded on the doorstep of the U.S. Attorney General's home in Washington, D.C. And this was followed by similar attacks that same night in six other cities. So it was, you know, really alarming year of events. And so on the one hand, you know, while the nation saw the explosion on Wall Street as this kind of shocking, understandably shocking, dark and evil event, it also seemed kind of inevitable after, you know, a year of sort of anger and political violence against industrial capitalism that the nation had been experiencing.
One of the primary figures in your film is someone who was completely unknown to me, and I suspect will be completely unknown to most people watching your film, and that is the Attorney General at the time, a man by the name of A. Mitchell Palmer, a really fascinating figure. And, of course, one of the things that especially makes him fascinating is the fact that he changes over time. He really, in a sense, sort of evolves and is transformed as a public figure through the course of these years of tension and ultimately crisis. Tell our listeners a little bit about Attorney General A. Mitchell Palmer, and particularly, in a sense, where he began and where he ended up.
Yeah, I think he is an interesting character and kind of a revealing character. I mean, to the extent that anybody has heard of him, they've maybe heard about the Palmer raids, which he authorized. And he's kind of gotten a bad name for himself as a result of that. But as you pointed out, it's sort of interesting that he didn't necessarily start out that way. You know, he was the Attorney General at the time of the Wall Street bombing. He'd been appointed by President Woodrow Wilson in 1919 to serve as his Attorney General. And he, in the year leading up to the bombing, had kind of argued that the nation needed to take more aggressive actions to protect itself from political violence. But when he was appointed by Wilson, that was sort of not, you know, his reputation. He was kind of an unlikely person to be championing such aggressive measures. He was a Quaker from Pennsylvania. He served three terms in Congress before his appointment, and during that time, he'd mostly done work to kind of help advance more progressive causes and introduced, you know, bills that might give women the right to vote or bar child labor. And over the course of his tenure in the office as serving as Attorney General, you know, he initially had been kind of a moderating influence on some of the more repressive measures that had been put in place during wartime. And anyway, he was considered by many to be a kind of possible presidential candidate after Wilson decided he wouldn't run again. But I think, you know, over the course of his service, you know, this increasing level of political violence, and the American public, in many ways, was sort of clamoring for action in the aftermath of this mail bombing campaign. And then when a bomb exploded on his own doorstep, I think he was sort of radicalized to some extent and began advocating far more aggressive action against, you know, radical agitators and taking much more repressive tactics to try and what he believed was necessary to prevent a future attack.
We're speaking with Susan Bellows, producer, director, writer of a fascinating film airing tonight on PBS, The American Experience, called The Bombing of Wall Street. I appreciated how your film introduces us to a phrase called propaganda of the deed, which really helps us understand the, in a sense, the mindset of some of these radicals, some of these anarchists who were trying to raise questions about capitalism, some of them wanting it to be drastically reformed, some wishing it to be eliminated altogether. Can you say a word about this notion of propaganda of the deed?
Well, since the early 1900s, you know, labor, revolutionary activist groups had really argued about how, you know, they could challenge what they perceived as the economic inequities of capitalism. And there were definitely anarchists and radical groups that believed terrorism and violence was useful tool for change, and you know, one of the most prominent out there was an Italian anarchist named Luigi Galliani, and he advocated what was known as sort of the propaganda of the deed, which is, you know, essentially violence, that violence was the only way to persuade and take action against things. And so, you know, he was a huge advocate of terrorism as a tool to challenge capitalism. He developed a fairly large following among manual laborers, mostly, many of them Italian immigrants at the time, and he himself was eventually deported in 1919, a year before the bombing on Wall Street. Some of the theories about, you know, they never solved the bombing, the investigation basically petered out, and they never basically were able to solve the case. But one of the lead theories in the case is that the bomb was set by a Italian who was a follower of, you know, this prominent anarchist, this Luigi Galliani, and that it was in some ways done as sort of revenge for him being deported.
In the wake of some of these actions, Attorney General Palmer, whom you said in some ways became kind of radicalized by what was going on around him, ended up launching quite a broad campaign basically against revolutionary groups of all stripes across our country with the establishment of something which came to be known as the Radical Division, headed by a young man by the name of J. Edgar Hoover. And your film spends quite a long time exploring what this radical division did and the extent to which they intended to root out all destructive revolutionary forces in this country to the point where they really generated some fierce criticism. Tell us more about what this group did and the ramifications both at that point in time and through the decades to today.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you know, in the aftermath of the bombing a year before the bomb exploded on Wall Street, Palmer, you know, in part in response to, you know, a sort of public outcry and pressure to do something to find the perpetrators of that bombing attack, set up a new domestic intelligence unit within the Justice Department that was designed to keep track of political groups and radical organizations. And it was fairly unusual to do something like this when the nation was not at war during peacetime, to set up something like this. The unit was called the Radical Division, and he appointed a young J. Edgar Hoover, who was just 24 years old at the time, and kind of a young up-and-coming employee within the Justice Department. He appointed Hoover to head up this division, and their purpose was really to gather information on radicals and radical activities in America. And so, you know, in their first year of operation, I think they amassed something like, you know, more than 200,000 files on radical activities. And so it, to some extent, you know, set up an infrastructure that, you know, continued for some time as a as an early domestic intelligence gathering tool under Hoover's supervision. It became a significant influence in Hoover's you know, future at the FBI, and something that he sort of built upon moving forward.
It's fascinating to see the extent to which this effort was underway. And of course, we've already said it sparked all kinds of criticism, including people very close to Attorney General Palmer himself, who saw this going way too far and causing great harm to perfectly innocent people. Let's return to the event itself that your film focuses on, this huge bomb on Wall Street in September of 1920. Say a word about just how huge this explosion was, the kind of damage that it did on that day, and the irony of who it ultimately impacted versus the kind of people that
the capitalist leaders
that probably were
so often.
Right.
Yeah, so it occurred as basically right at noon on Wall Street in the center of the financial district. This horse-drawn cart was packed with dynamite, and it was essentially parked in front of the Morgan Bank, which at the time was the world's most powerful banking institution. And so the timing of the blast meant that office workers were basically just heading out onto their lunch hour. And so, as you pointed out, you know, many of the people killed were the workers employed in the financial districts, clerks, typists, you know, messengers, vendors on the street. And it immediately killed 38 people and sent hundreds more to the hospital. But the descriptions in the newspaper, you know, accounts of the event really recall a financial district that was kind of instantly transformed into kind of a war zone. And you certainly see it in the footage that we used in the film as well. It, you know, rattled buildings up in Midtown. It shattered windows. It was, you know, wreaked havoc on the entire financial district, and really, really sent fears around the country, as you mentioned. And, you know, no one ever claimed responsibility for it.
Susan Bellows is senior producer, director, and writer of this fascinating film that airs tonight on PBS stations across the country. The documentary is called The Bombing of Wall Street.